Okay, good. So the next speaker will be Donal O'Connell, who's going to tell us about classical double copies.
Okay, so let me begin by thanking the organizers for inviting me to speak here. It's been a marvelous conference. We're all amazed at the high standard of the organization here. Anyway, so today I'm going to tell you a little bit about, a slightly different topic from what we've heard about so far during the meeting. So the idea here is that there could be some relations between gravity and gauge theory at the level of solutions of the classical field equations. Let me first begin by thanking my collaborators as well. I've been working on this stuff for a while now with Ricardo Montero and Chris White, who are going around in the audience. But most recently, we've been working with Andres Luna Garoy, who's a PhD student of Chris up in Glasgow. Okay, so it said the basic idea is, people in this room are really good at computing scattering amplitudes, and tree-level scattering amplitudes are, these are the easiest ones of all. We also know that there's a close connection between scattering amplitudes in Yang-Mills theory and in gravity. So we can think about this in various ways. We could use the KLT relations or the more recently developed BCJ story. So, my reasoning is as follows. So suppose we start with the Yang-Mills Lagrangian. So from there we can compute a bunch of scattering amplitudes. With those scattering amplitudes, I could feed those through some machine, the KLT relations, for example, and get gravitational scattering amplitudes. And if I know a bunch of gravity scattering amplitudes, well, you'd think that surely if you've got a lot of amplitudes, you can figure out what the action of the theory is. Right? This is kind of what we do at the LHC, right? You scatter stuff, we discover there are Higgs bosons there. If you've got the action, then you can find the classical equations of motion and solve it, and start investigating some interesting gravitational systems. So, this is the basic idea that we're exploring. Of course, to do that in practice, we need to start by understanding as clearly as possible the classical relations, the amplitude relations between Yang-Mills theory and gravity. So here I've got a very brief sort of lightning introduction to BCJ. I think this story is familiar to many people in the room. I just want to emphasize some points that are important for our classical field solution story. So for the BCJ story begins by organizing, just tree-level scattering amplitudes for now. We'll organize them in terms of some sum over cubic diagrams. So that's easy to do. We can always do that. The objects that appear in the sum are very familiar. So these DIs are just some scalar propagators. So if you've got some tree-level diagram, you'll see some propagators there, and you just write the scalar propagators in the denominator. These CIs are color factors. This is the plain color factors you write down in Yang-Mills theory. They're made up out of the structure constants of the Lie algebra that you picked when you're defining your gauge theory. And the rest of the stuff here, these NIs, are the hard parts, right? So this is where the kinematic information is. These Ns are kinematic numerators. So they're built up of things like the momenta and the polarization vectors that are involved in the scattering process. So these things are hard to find. Notice that they're also not unique. For example, we can choose different gauges. In this sum, I could just shuffle some terms from one place to an X. So these NIs are, there's some big space of these NIs. And what BCJ told us to do was it told us to pick a particular set of numerators. So the recipe is that any time three diagrams in your sum here have the property that their color factors add up to zero, it's just a Jacobi relation, so it's pure group theory. Any time that's true, you have to find kinematic numerators that satisfy precisely the same identity, this Jacobi-like identity. The advantage of doing that is you can easily write down scattering amplitude and gravity once you've found these numerators. So the gravity scattering amplitude is obtained from the Yang-Mills scattering amplitude simply by replacing those CIs, those color factors, by another copy of the kinematic numerator, these NIs, right? So that's the advantage. So notice that this is some kind of gauge prescription. So there's some redundancy in these ends, and what the guys told us to do was essentially to pick a particular kind of funny gauge which is the property that it lines up scattering amplitudes in gauge theory and gravity. Okay. Now, at tree level, we know that you can always do this, and it's always going to work. Many people in the room have worked on this, so that definitely works. At loop level, there is an obvious conjecture. Well, I say obvious, I guess. Seems obvious now that it's been conjectured. But there's a conjecture for what you should do. And it's basically the same idea, right? You say, well, you know, there's some diagrams. Now, the diagrams are loops, so there are undetermined momenta flowing around in those loops, and you integrate over them on both sides. That remains a conjecture. It's led to a huge amount of progress in our understanding of high loop gravity scattering amplitudes. And I think we're going to hear quite a lot more about this momentarily in JJ's undoubtedly marvelous talk. Okay. Well, now, having explained the background on BCJ, let me describe a class of metrics, or class of spacetimes in general relativity, which I claim are going to be related to the BCJ story. So, the metrics I'm going to be interested in are going to have a structure which is very similar to the structure of the BCJ story in scattering amplitudes. So these spacetimes are called Kerr-Shields spacetimes, and they have the property that the metric takes this form here. So G mu nu is the full metric of spacetime, and this metric is, it can be written in terms of the Minkowski metric plus K mu K nu phi. So firstly, this is an exact statement, right? So these spacetimes exactly have this metric. And this K has some very nice properties. So K has the property that it squares to zero with respect to the Minkowski metric and the full metric of spacetime. So it's a null vector either with E mu nu or with G mu nu. So that's very nice because it means that you can write down the inverse metric in a very straightforward manner. The inverse metric is given here. And you see that if you multiply these things together, the fact that K squares to zero makes this all work out. So the inverse metric is nice and simple. Which, of course, is great, because typically in general relativity, when you write down some metric and it's nice, stops somewhere, you understand it, the inverse metric is often quite horrible. But in Kerr-Shield, the inverse metric is every bit as simple as the metric you started out with. Okay, so I'm going to call this this field H mu nu, which is K mu K nu phi. I'll call it graviton. That's just language, right? So I'm not doing any perturbative approximation, and this thing is not necessarily a wave, but it's a convenient name for it. In any case, in terms of this graviton, these Kerr-Shield spacetimes have a remarkable property. So that property is that the Einstein equations, it's just this. This is the Einstein equation. For a vacuum spacetime. So notice that this Einstein equation is linear. That's an exact statement. So in these Kerr-Shield metrics, somehow, for some reason, the Einstein equation is just linearized. So, well, you might think, gosh, this guy is talking about some pretty esoteric spacetimes. We all know that the Einstein equations are complicated set of partial differential equations. Probably thinking that there's no interesting spacetimes that are in this class. But in fact, it's not like that at all. Almost all of the metrics that you know and love are Kerr-Shield somehow. So, for example, Schwarzschild is Kerr-Shield. I guess the reason for this is the metrics that you know and love are simple. And one way metrics can be simple is by being Kerr-Shield. So. Evidently, I should gesticulate less enthusiastically. Okay. So, the other thing you might think is, if these Kerr-Shield metrics are so, are so simple, then there should be a similar simplicity reflected in the gauge theory side. So, indeed, that's going to be the case. The gauge theory counterparts of these gravitational spacetimes are going to turn out to be solutions of the Maxwell equations. So the gauge theory linearizes too. Okay, well, what's this got to do with BCJ? Right? Well, I think you can sort of see the pattern if you just look at this expression for the graviton there. I'm talking about a double copy. Double copies of the property that you're supposed to have squared something, some kinematic numerator that had polarization vectors in it, had space-time indices in it. And there were supposed to be some propagators going around the place that, work in common between gauge theory and gravity. So in view of that, you think, well, if I look at that expression, maybe an appropriate single copy of it would be saying, there's a gauge field going around here, and it's just k mu times phi. Now, indeed, that works. So what works, it works in the sense that if you look at the Einstein equations for these Kerr-Shields spacetimes, and decompose it appropriately, you find that that this gauge field satisfies the Maxwell equations. So I have in mind here stationary solutions, which have the property there that the time derivatives vanish. And in particular, I'm also taking k0 equal to 1. But then you find that the Einstein equations imply the Maxwell equations. And also, crucially, they imply that the scalar field is a propagator. So what I mean by that is if you switch on some source for that scalar field, then the solution of the scalar field is just going to be 1 over d squared integrated against the source. So it's going to be a bunch of propagators, right? So now there are other cases. So I said, we know that any stationary Kerr-Shield metric has this property. Well, there are other cases that work as well. I'll discuss one. We don't have a completely systematic story here. We're just scratching the surface, I think, of some structures. Okay, so, well, I'm telling you, there's some relationship between Kerr-Shield and BCJ. Should you believe me? Well, the reason we think there's a relationship is, it's a couple of things I've already touched on. There's this distinguished role of the scalar field in both stories, this Kerr-Shield story and the BCJ story. There's this sort of double copy in the sense that Kerr-Shield spacetimes have this vector k. You need two copies of the vector k to get gravitational solution. There are other cases where you can understand things quite clearly. So an example is the self-fuel sector of gauge theory and gravity. So in that case, we can really understand how BCJ works. It also connects to these Kerr-Shield solutions in the sense that the self-fuel theories can be expressed in sort of Kerr-Shield-like. So the point here is that this vector K, instead of being a vector, an ordinary vector, becomes a linear differential operator. But it's basically the same idea. If you plug these expressions for the gauge field, which should be an A on that phi, into the Young-Mills equation, this expression into the Einstein equations, you get precisely the known equations of motion for self-fuel gauge theory and self-fuel gravity in precisely the form where the gauges line up, in the sense that if you do perturbative calculations, and the BCJ story just works. So you square a kinematic numerator in the gauge theory side to get the gravitational side. So the gauge choice lines up on both sides in the self-fuel story when you use this Kerr-Shield-like ansatz. So finally, another reason to think that there's some close connections here is that shockwave solutions are Kerr-Shield. And we already know that these are closely connected to amplitude. So this is the work of Satoni and Akuri before we started looking at this. So these are the reasons we think that there's some relationship between these things. I think it's very encouraging. So let me give you some examples now of this stuff at work. So the first example are black holes. Black holes are cool. So it's always the first example. So the Schwarzschild black hole in Kerr-Shield, it really is extraordinarily simple. So the scalar field phi for Schwarzschild is just basically 1 over or. The Kerr-Shield vector is 1 comma or hat, where that or hat is, the unit radial vector that we all use in our undergraduate classes on electromagnetism. So it's a very simple vector. You could follow the rules to write down what the single copy of this thing would be. This is basically the BCJ rules. So I should only write one factor of that Kerr-Shield vector K. I should leave the propagators completely untouched. And other than this, there's just some replacements of coupling constants. So you immediately write down this gauge solution here. And what is this? Well, it's nothing but the Coulomb point charge. It's in a slightly funny gauge because there's a vector potential switched on, but that vector potential is curl free. So it's nothing but the Coulomb charge. That's a very simple case, but there are many other cases that work out just the same. So, for example, the Kerr black hole is kind of a complicated-looking thing, but it's just as simple for us. There's some scalar field phi. you can write down an appropriate single copy for this thing. It's the interpretation of just a disk of charge. It's got a funny charge distribution on it. You can give your undergraduates problems on it, which is great. So also higher dimensional generalizations of these. For example, the Myers-Perry black holes are kind of complicated looking beasts. These are spinning black holes in higher dimensions. There are various different planes that they can have angular momentum in. But again, you know, this double copy, it works completely uniformly. Another interesting example is de Sitter space or anti-de Sitter space. So in these cases, the Kerr-Shield expression for the metric just has a lambda R squared switched on here. So the sign of lambda is going to distinguish between de Sitter and anti-de Sitter space. The single copy is just, you know, obtained by the same rules. You just keep the scalar function the same and just write down one copy of the vector. Might look slightly funny again in that expression, but you can gauge transform it into a very simple expression. You get rid of the vector potential part. So you could see that this, you know, if you just differentiate it twice, there's nothing but constant charge density filling space. That's all that's going on here. The electric field is radially outward, so you solve this equation, the Poisson equation, with some boundary conditions, spherical symmetry. One nice thing about this is that KMU there is the same as the KMU in Schwarzschild. Right? So the equations for the Einstein equations in these Kerr-Shield metrics are linear, but they're only linear in a specific sense. So they're only linear, you know, to see that they're linear, you had to use that this graviton, H mu nu, was K mu, K nu phi, where K squares to zero. So even though the equation is linear in that sense, it's not like you can superimpose solutions with different Kerr-Shield vectors. However, if the Kerr-Shield vector is the same, then you can just add solutions. So if you want to think about a black hole in de Sitter space or an ADS, you just have to add that scalar field, that lambda R squared, to the 1 over R for the black hole. So the metric for, you know, ADS Schwarzschild is just going to take this form. And a single copy, then, is just as simple to think about, right? And there's a point charge in some bath, some charge density. That's all it is. So third example I want to talk about today is Taub-Nut. So Taub-Nut is kind of an interesting space-time. It has two parameters. I'm just going to talk about two today. So there's a mass, and it also has something called a nut charge, called N. For appropriate parameters, Taub-Nut is an instanton. So, and it's also not Kerr-Shield. So, you know, at first we were, you know, not quite puzzled about this space-time. But one thing that's nice about Kerr-Shield is that it has the property that it's double Kerr-Shield. So, you can write the metric Taub-Nut in this form. So there's some fiducial metric, G bar. So that could be Minkowski. I'll just talk about the Minkowski space case now. But you can also consider more non-trivial backgrounds. For example, DS Taub-Nut or ADS Taub-Nut. So you can consider some more interesting background there. There are two sort of Kerr-Shield-like terms. That's why it gets this double Kerr-Shield name. So there's a phi k mu k nu and the psi l mu l nu. These vectors, so k squares to zero, just as before. Also l squares to zero. K dot l is zero, so that the inverse metric here is just as simple to write down. There are some other conditions on these vectors k and l. So this was also true for a single Kerr-Shield. This vector k has to be geodesic, basically. It has to satisfy the geodesic equation. And the same for l in this double Kerr-Shield case. So you can generalize a little bit more if you want. You can consider Taub-Nut, which has some rotation in it. So this would be DS Kerr, for example, Taub-Nut. Anyhow, so we want to think about, you know, what is an appropriate single copy of this, and, you know, what's the physical interpretation of it. So, well, it's straightforward to, you know, it's pretty easy to guess if you follow the rules what you should do. Although the algebra is a little bit more messy. I won't get into the details of the algebra. But given a solution like this, so I factored out here just the coupling constants and the masses. So it turns out that they're linear. So the Taub-Nut is linear in M here. The phi just has a linear factor of M. And the psi has a linear factor of the nut charge. So, well, these phis in size, what they are is, they satisfy some linear equation. These are the objects which are we interpret as being the analog of propagators in the BCJ story. And notice that the structure of this phi and psi, it's different. So they correspond to different sets of propagators. Now, in BCJ, we draw diagrams. But, for different diagrams, the different diagrams have different propagators, and you just add the expressions for different diagrams, right? And so you get the amplitude. So the single copy of this, the natural single copy, would be to say, okay, well, I should write one factor of K, one factor of L, multiply by the propagators and add them. And so we think about these as different kinds of diagrams. If you do so, you find that the field strength, if we want to interpret this is just Yang-Mills theory. I can always understand what the solution is like if I compute the field strength, because it's gauge invariant. And we find that the field strength has this form. So there's a charge over R squared times dt wedge dr. So that charge is just coming from the mass parameter in tau nut. So it's just the same as in Schwarzschild. Indeed, if we took the nut charge to zero, this tau nut would just degenerate to Schwarzschild. But when the nut charge is switched on, we get this second term here, which is just the dual. So it's just star 1 over R squared dt wedge dr with some charge multiplying it. And of course, we recognize that as the field strength of, it's just a magnetic field that's been switched on. So this is the field strength of a magnetic monopole. Adding the two together, you've got a diam. So this single copy of tau nut is a diam. Another interesting thing about this, of course, is I mentioned that tau nut is a gravitational instanton for appropriate values of the mass and the nut charge. So if you look at this, you take the same appropriate electric and magnetic charges, then this thing becomes self-dual. So it would be an electromagnetic instanton. Okay, so, well, of course, when you have magnetic monopoles in the game, there's one thing that we all immediately think about, which is the Dirac quantization condition. So there's got to be some relation between that charge and that magnetic monopole if you want the space-time to have the property that the Dirac string doesn't have any physical implications. So it's just the same in tau nut. There's a quantization condition on that mass and nut charge if you want the space-time to have the property that it's got spherical symmetry. So it's just the same story. Okay, so with that, let me conclude. My mission today has been to tell you that, we know a lot about amplitudes. We know a lot about the relationship between amplitudes in gauge theory and in gravity. And, there's an infinite number of relations. There's a lot of information there. So this information, can lead to, we know it's going to lead to some relations between the classical field solutions, between the physical data going beyond scattering amplitudes. So we can start to explore this. I mean, there seems to be a rich range of interesting relations at the level of these classical field theories. I've just been talking about things with basically point particles. There's much more to do. Obviously, in amplitudes, we scatter things. They interact. They're not just one point particle going around not doing a lot. So what we'd like to do in this game in the future is to find more non-trivial solutions with interactions that are really going on in the core of space-time. So we know that we're pretty good at computing interactions in Yang-Mills theory. So it should be that we can really understand non-trivial interactions in these space-times. So maybe we can get a better understanding of gravitational physics using the methods we've been developing. Okay, thanks.
Okay, so thanks to Donald for that very nice talk. Are there any questions?
Yeah, I have a question. So if you have this kind of the theta space double copy structure, can you use it to calculate something like the Long-Gaussian entity for the inflationary cosmology from QED scattering amplitude?
That's a great question, yeah. I think you should work on that. I'd hope that you can do this. Yeah, I mean, this is really a very good question. Indeed, the situation you're talking about is essentially free field theory. It seems like a really good idea. I haven't thought about it, but I would hope you can do that calculation.
Suppose you take some general gravity solution. Very, very late time, in the asymptotic flat space, it becomes stationary. Could you say that every such solution that very late becomes stationary can be decomposed into these Kirchhoff-type solutions?
No. So these Kirchhoff spacetimes are a special class of spacetimes. Not every spacetime is going to be Kirchhoff, like even if it's stationary. Not everything is going to be Kirchhoff, so this is some special class of solutions. However, if you have a solution in your hand, and if you have a particular solution in mind, there's every chance that if you type name of solution Kirchhoff into Google, that you will be rewarded for that investigation. Is that most of the spacetimes we really deal with are Kirchhoff or similar to it somehow, but it's not true that every spacetime is Kirchhoff. Of course. My point of view on this is that the Kirchhoff stuff is just a limitation of what we know how to do today. I would hope that in future we know how to do other spacetimes. So the point about Kirchhoff is it's some class of gauges where things line up. But we expect that things are going to line up much more generally. So it's just a question of figuring out a more general prescription analogous to the BCJ, the kinematic Jacobi statement. And then, yes, hopefully we can do anything. Yeah.
So very nice talk. I had two kind of interrelated questions. One is whether the causal structure of the space-time becomes encoded in some interesting way on the gauge theory side. And also, have you looked at the dynamics of point probes and how they relate in the two cases?
So the second question is much easier. No, we haven't. I think the issue with that is if you have more than one particle moving around the space-time, I guess if you want to make the particle soft somehow, things should become simple. But if the particle is hard somehow, then you should start to probe the non-abelian structure on the gauge theory side. Right. So
just geodesic equation on the gravity side and...
Okay.
Something as simple as this.
Yeah, I don't really have anything useful to tell you about that. And indeed, regarding the causal structure, if you look at the metrics in Kirchhoff form, the way I usually think about these things is that there is just some field, like this phi is just some field propagating on a Minkowski background. So from that point of view, you'd imagine that there's got to be some link between the causal structure.
I have two questions which are probably related. One, the graviton has 2 degrees of freedom. You seem to have only 5 there. In addition, when you do BGJ, you get also the dilaton amplitude from the gauge theory amplitude. How do you get them there?
Okay, good. Well, so the dilaton, in principle is there. There's some nice things about this Kirchhoff story which allows me to think about the dilaton in a couple of ways. So first of all, I could say, I'm just doing classical field theory, so I can imagine just switching the dilaton off, provided there's no source for it. But in this Kirchhoff case, there's a very good reason for thinking that the dilaton should be set to zero. So the dilaton, you should think about that as sitting inside the trace of this graviton. So the trace of the graviton would be k upper mu, k lower mu phi. But since k squared to zero, the dilaton just vanishes. It's just gone. Yes, well, I guess there's also we have this k squared phi, k squared set to zero. It's also manifest that the thing is symmetric. So we've got a symmetric traceless metric. So in that sense, the anti-symmetric tensor has gone away. I would like to be able to put these things in. One thing that we know how to do in the BCJ story is to put in, is have asymmetric double copies. So you can take kinematic numerators for one gauge theory times the kinematic numerators for another, and that works. But here I only know how to do symmetric double copies where the fields are the same on both sides. So that's why we're not really sourcing a dilaton or an anti-symmetric tensor. So the other thing about the degree of freedom counting, Well, since when you're solving classical field equations, the degree of freedom counting, is not quite so sharp. But indeed, there should still be two perturbations. I mean, that's also an open question. We'd like to have, scatter some particles around these solutions that have the property that they're going to have 2 degrees of freedom. But it's an open question how to do that.
So you're mentioning on the first to last slide that for certain relations between electric and magnetic charges, you get an instanton.
Yeah.
Instantons usually come with moduli. Do you know what the moduli represent for the top knot? The gauge moduli probably don't mean anything, but there is a scale.
This is something that we should look into. I mean, I think there's every reason to think that there's some relationships between instantons are solutions of the self-dual equations. We already know that there's some kind of relationship between the self-dual equations. I mean, it's not clear how you make non-perturbative statements about these things. If you just look at the equations, they're similar, but that's not quite good enough. This further motivates the thought that there's more detailed relations amongst these theories, perhaps also amongst their moduli spaces. But I haven't started to think about this.
Okay, so we had lots of questions. If there are further ones, perhaps I propose that we ask Donal after the next talk. So let's thank Donal again. Thanks.